Thanks, Andrew. Good morning, everyone. So our paper on education and training interventions is a little different from the others in that it's less research, academic-oriented, and more practice-oriented. It's basically intent was to take a snapshot of the state-of-the-art of education and training for these particularly vulnerable populations that we've been talking about. And this was a collaborative effort of a large group of people, myself, Mike Flynn, Deborah Weinstock, and Joe Zanoni as the primary writing group, but we had input from an advisory group that contributed a great deal. And I'm hoping that this is going to be a living document that's going to continue to expand and increase with information from all of you in this room and many other people around the country who can add their experiences to it over time. I have no financial relationships to disclose. So as I said, the purpose of the paper was to provide an overview of all the different approaches to education and training for these populations and to identify some specific issues that trainers should consider when they're planning on designing a successful program. So we thought when we looked at these programs, we realized that they could be divided into three sort of general categories, and we need to think about what the primary purpose of our training is. Is it to transmit knowledge about chemical hazard, for example? Is it to change attitudes towards workers about the importance or seriousness of these hazards? Or is it to try to motivate them to take action to decrease their exposure to these hazards in the workplace? And ideally, a good training program would be a combination of all three. This slide is essentially saying if you're thinking about designing a training program, you need to take into consideration everything that Paul and Cassandra and Sherry just talked about in terms of work organization and the overall structure that the trainees are embedded in society. And that the unionized or even non-union but stable worker that has been the primary focus of much workplace health and safety training over the past 50 years or so now is being replaced in many cases by contingent workers and in some cases undocumented workers who are at the farthest end of this spectrum where they are most vulnerable and least likely to take action. So when we're thinking about what we can achieve in a training program, we have to understand the serious limitations that those structural context puts on people. Our paper looked at not only direct worker training programs, but also a variety of other approaches, including sort of broader public education, social marketing programs, and we've seen some great examples of that. The California Department of Public Health did this fabulous video and training program on lead-based paint hazards for Latino construction workers. There was another example in the construction industry where public health people combined with people in the TV industry to embed a construction safety message in a Spanish language telenovela or a soap opera, which I thought was really creative and interesting project, and I think there's a lot of potential for that in the future. We also looked a lot at train-the-trainer programs. We all know that people like us going to speak to groups of workers are much less effective than workers themselves speaking to their coworkers, and that's been proven through a huge body of research over the last 20 years or so. And related to that, lay health advisor programs or health promoter or promotora programs that have been used successfully in public health in a variety of themes have been beginning to be used more in the occupational health and safety area to great effect. So we looked at some specific training techniques and described these in the paper, and we can only just review them very quickly today, but the training techniques based on the principles of popular education, for example, doing risk mapping, as this example shows here, some poultry workers in North Carolina drawing a map of their workplace, and the idea here is that workers themselves can identify hazards in their workplace better than people from the outside sometimes. Identify different priorities than you or I as health and safety professionals might, and so this gives them an opportunity to identify what they see as important in their workplace. Body mapping, we saw a slide of earlier where workers are identifying the aches and pains and symptoms that they experience on the job. Small group activities to solve problems where groups of trainees are given a challenging problem that they face in the workplace and asked to work together to strategize, to come up with solutions for how they would realistically address a problem, not just give the right answer to the professor about what should be done, but considering these serious structural problems that they face, that they might in fact lose their job if they speak up about health and safety, how would they deal with that problem? Role plays or theater. This is a training we did in Chicago where we had an amazingly creative, lively bunch of workers who took on a problem that where they presented it in a theatrical way of how they would address a health and safety problem when the management was not responding. Telling a story using graphic materials where you have low literacy trainees is a great way to get information out without using a lot of words. We looked at a lot of social and cultural factors that need to be considered in designing a training program, particularly the cultural appropriateness of training materials and activities, thinking about what might be, what message might work better for one culture versus another, and we have a lot of examples in the paper of that. The prior experience of trainees and trainers, sometimes we think of that the trainee, say you have an immigrant worker, construction worker in a training project, and you don't realize that that person actually was a professor back in their home country, and they don't actually have a lot of experience in the construction industry, and that they may have knowledge about a lot of other things that you don't realize that they have. Likewise with the trainers, we have to be aware of that our experience as trainers sometimes doesn't give us the information and knowledge about a particular industry or hazard that the workers in our training class might have, and that they can teach us a lot. And particularly the documentation status of trainees is an important issue that we can never underestimate. If you go into a training and you have expectations that workers are going to be able to take action, and it turns out most of them are undocumented, you have to be very realistic about the limitations that that imposes. And we would like to be able to tell workers that OSHA doesn't care about your documentation status, that doesn't matter. Legally, that's true, but the reality is workers who speak up about health and safety are retaliated against every day, and if you're an undocumented worker, there is a possibility that speaking up about your health and safety hazards might not only get you fired, but you could end up getting deported, and we can't guarantee somebody that that's not going to happen. So we have to be very careful about the message that we give to undocumented workers. Challenges of training these populations, particularly that we address in the paper, the language issues in addition to the literacy issues we mentioned before. Working with interpreters has a whole set of challenges that I'm sure anybody who's done this has encountered. Oftentimes, if you get someone who's not a professional interpreter, you never know exactly how much is getting through. If you have people doing simultaneous interpretation, that can be a much more effective way, but it's expensive. So those are often difficulties that community-based organizations face when they're trying to do training for immigrant workers. The structural barriers and power relations, again, this goes back to the work organization and workplace injustice papers. If you do a training for a group of workers, you telling them about the hazards and their rights on the job, you might hear back from them, well, we know our rights on the job, we know what the hazards are, that's not the problem. The problem is that our boss needs to be educated. They are the ones whose behavior needs to change. So we have to be prepared to answer that question and to address that reality in a training program and not assume that it's just ignorance, lack of knowledge, or lack of motivation on the part of the workers that's the obstacle. Competing priorities is a constant problem in dealing with underserved populations. For example, workers who are working three different jobs, time constraints is another related issue. Learning about workplace health and safety may not be the top priority for those groups. And one way we can get around that is by trying to integrate health and safety training into sessions with other information about how to find a job, how to get a driver's license, other things that are seen as more practical, high priority issues. And we're about out of time, so I would just refer you to the paper to see the other information we have to offer, particularly about issues related to evaluation of these programs, which was the other aspect of our paper. So I think we'll wrap up with that. Thank you.